its nuclear umbrella kinda puts the world title out of reach. Which is okay. Sometimes it's all right just to be a little bad. To know your limitations. Make do with what you've got. Once he maneuvers his way onto the freeway, aimed up into the mountains, he goggles into his office. Earth is still there, zoomed in tight on the raft. Hiro contemplates it, superimposed in ghostly hues on his view of the highway as he rides toward Oregon at 140 miles per hour. From a distance, it looks bigger than it really is. Getting closer, he can see that this illusion is caused by an enveloping, self-made slick-slash-cloud of sewage and air pollution fading out into the ocean and the atmosphere. It orbits the Pacific clockwise. When they fire up the boilers on the Enterprise, it can control its direction a little bit. But real navigation is a practical impossibility with all the other shit lashed onto it. It mostly has to go where the wind and the Coriolis effect take it. A couple of years ago, it was going by the Philippines, Vietnam, China, Siberia, picking up refuse. Then it swung up the Aleutian chain, down the Alaska Panhandle, and now it's gliding past the small town of Port Sherman, Oregon, near the California border. As the raft moves through the Pacific, riding mostly on ocean currents, it occasionally sheds great hunks of itself. Eventually, these fragments wash up in some place like Santa Barbara, still lashed together, carrying a payload of skeletons and gnawed bones. When it gets to California, it will enter a new phase of its life cycle. It will shed much of its sprawling, improvised bulk as a few hundred thousand refuse cut themselves loose and paddle to shore. The only refuse who make it that far are, by definition, the ones who were agile enough to make it out to the raft in the first place, resourceful enough to survive the agonizingly slow passage through the Arctic waters, and tough enough not to get killed by any of the other refuse. Nice guys, all of them. Just the kind of people you'd like to have showing up on your private beach in groups of a few thousand. Stripped down to a few major ships, a little more maneuverable, the Enterprise then will swing across the South Pacific, heading for Indonesia, where it will turn north again and start the next cycle of migration. Army ants cross mighty rivers by climbing on top of each other and clustering together into a little ball that floats. Many of them fall off and sink, and naturally the ants in the bottom of the ball drown. The ones who are quick and vigorous enough to keep clawing their way to the top survive. A lot of them make it across, and that's why you can't stop army ants by dynamiting the bridges. That's how refuse come across the Pacific. Even though they are too poor to book passage on a real ship or buy a seaworthy boat, a new wave washes up onto the West Coast every 5 years or so, when the ocean currents bring the Enterprise back. For the last couple of months, owners of beachfront property in California have been hiring security people, putting up spotlights and anti-personnel fences along the tide line, mounting machine guns on their yachts. They have all subscribed to CIC's 24-hour raft report, getting the latest news flash straight from the satellite on when the latest contingent of 25,000 starving Eurasians has cut itself loose from the Enterprise and started dipping its myriad oars into the Pacific like ant legs. Time to do more digging, he tells the librarian. But this is going to have to be totally verbal, because I'm heading up I-5 at some incredible speed right now, and I have to watch out for slow-moving bagos and stuff.
I'll keep that in mind, the voice of the librarian says into his earphones. Look out for the jackknife truck south of Santa Clarita, and there is a large chuck hole in the left lane near the Tulare exit.
Thanks. Who are these gods, anyway? Did Lagos have an opinion on that?
Lagos believed that they might have been magicians, that is, normal human beings with special powers, or they might have been aliens.
Whoa, hold on. Let's take these one at a time. What did Lagos mean when he talked about normal human beings with special powers?
Assume that the Namshub of Enki really functioned as a virus, Assume that someone named Enki invented it. Then Enki must have had some kind of linguistic power that goes beyond our concept of normal.
And how would this power work? What's the mechanism?
I can only give you forward references drawn by Lagos.
Okay, give me some.
The belief in the magical power of language is not unusual, both in mystical and academic literature. The Kabbalists, Jewish mystics of Spain and Palestine, believed that supernormal insight and power could be derived from properly combining the letters of the divine name. For example, Abu Aharon, an early Kabbalist who emigrated from Baghdad to Italy, was said to perform miracles through the power of the sacred names.
What kind of power are we talking about here?
Most Kabbalists were theorists who were interested only in pure meditation. But there were so-called practical Kabbalists who tried to apply the power of the Kabbalah in everyday life.
In other words, sorcerers.
Yes. These practical Kabbalists used a so-called archangelic alphabet, derived from first-century Greek and Aramaic theurgic alphabets, which resembled cuneiform. The Kabbalists referred to this alphabet as I-writing, because the letters were composed of lines and small circles which resembled eyes,
ones and zeros.
Some Kabbalists divided up the letters of the alphabet according to where they were produced inside the mouth.
Okay, so as we would think of it, they were drawing a connection between the printed letter on the page and the neural connections that had to be invoked in order to pronounce it.
Yes. By analyzing the spelling of various words, they were able to draw what they thought were profound conclusions about their true inner meaning and significance.
Okay, if you say so.
In the academic realm, the literature is naturally not as fanciful. But a great deal of effort has been devoted to explaining Babel. Not the Babel event, which most people consider to be a myth, but the fact that languages tend to diverge. A number of linguistic theories have been developed in an effort to tie all languages together.
Theories Lagos tried to apply to his virus hypothesis.
Yes, there are two schools, relativists and universalists. As George Steiner summarizes it, relativists tend to believe that language is not the vehicle of thought, but its determining medium. It is the framework of cognition. Our perceptions of everything are organized by the flux of sensations passing over that framework. Hence, the study of the evolution of language is the study of the evolution of the human mind itself.
Okay, I could see the significance of that. What about the universalists?
In contrast with the relativists, who believe that languages need not have anything in common with each other, the universalists believe that if you can analyze languages enough, you can find that all of them have certain traits in common. So they analyze languages looking for such traits.
Have they found any?
No. There seems to be an exception to every rule.
Which blows universalism out of the water.
Not necessarily. They explain this problem by saying that the shared traits are too deeply buried to be analyzable.
Which is a cop-out.
Their point is that at some level, language has to happen inside the human brain, since all human brains are more or less the same.
The hardware's the same, not the software.
You are using some kind of metaphor that I cannot understand.
Hero whips past a big airstream that is rocking from side to side in a dangerous wind coming down the valley. Well, a French speaker's brain starts out the same as an English speaker's brain. As they grow up, they get programmed with different software. They learn different languages.
Yes. Therefore, according to the universalists, French and English, or any other languages, must share certain traits that have their roots in the deep structures of the human brain. According to Chomskyan theory, the deep structures are innate components of the brain that enable it to carry out certain formal kinds of operations on strings of symbols. Or, as Steiner paraphrases Emin Bach, These deep structures eventually lead to the actual patterning of the cortex, with its immensely ramified, yet at the same time, programmed network of electrochemical and neurophysiological channels.
But these deep structures are so deep we can't even see them?
The Universalists place the active nodes of linguistic life, the deep structures, so deep as to defy observation and description. Or to use Steiner's analogy, try to draw up the creature from the depths of the sea, and it will disintegrate or change form grotesquely.
There's that serpent again.
So which theory did Lagos believe in? The relativist or the universalist? He did not seem to think there was much of a difference. In the end, they are both somewhat mystical. Lagos believed that both schools of thought had essentially arrived at the same place by different lines of reasoning.
But it seems to me there is a key difference, Hero says. The universalists think that we are determined by the pre-patterned structure of our brains, the pathways in the cortex. The relativists don't believe that we have any limits.
Lagos modified the strict Chomskyan theory by supposing that learning a language is like blowing code into proms, an analogy that I cannot interpret.
The analogy is clear. Proms are programmable read-only memory chips, Hero says. When they come from the factory, they have no content. Once and only once, you can place information into those chips and then freeze it. The information, the software, becomes frozen into the chip. It transmutes into hardware. After you have blown the code into the proms, you can read it out, but you can't write to them anymore. So Lagos was trying to say that the newborn human brain has no structure, as the relativists would have it, and that as the child learns a language, the developing brain structures itself accordingly. The language gets blown into the hardware and becomes a permanent part of the brain's deep structure, as the universalists would have it.
Yes, this was his interpretation.
Okay, so when he talked about Enki being a real person with magical powers, what he meant was that Enki somehow understood the connection between language and the brain, knew how to manipulate it. The same way that a hacker, knowing the secrets of a computer system, can write code to control it. Digital namshubs.
Lagos said that Enki had the ability to ascend into the universe of language and see it before his eyes, much as humans go into the metaverse. That gave him power to create namshubs. And namshubs had the power to alter the functioning of the brain and of the body.
Why isn't anyone doing this kind of thing nowadays? Why aren't there any namshubs in English?
Not all languages are the same, as Steiner points out. Some languages are better at metaphor than others. Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, and Chinese lend themselves to wordplay and have achieved a lasting grip on reality. Palestine had Kiryat Sefer, the city of the letter, and Syria had Byblos, the town of the book. By contrast, other civilizations seem speechless, or at least, as may have been the case in Egypt, not entirely cognizant of the creative and transformational powers of language. Lagos believed that Sumerian was an extraordinarily powerful language. At least it was in Sumer 5,000 years ago. A language that lent itself to Enki's neurolinguistic hacking. Early linguists, as well as the Kabbalists, believed in a fictional language called the Tongue of Eden, the language of Adam. It enabled all men to understand each other, to communicate without misunderstanding. It was the language of the Logos, the moment when God created the world by speaking a word. In the Tongue of Eden, naming a thing was the same as creating it. To quote Steiner again, quote, "Our speech interposes itself between apprehension and truth like a dusty pane or warped mirror. The Tongue of Eden was like a flawless glass. A light of total understanding streamed through it. Thus Babel was a second fall." And Isaac the Blind, an early Kabbalist, said that, to quote Gershom Scholem's translation,
The speech of men is connected with divine speech, and all language, whether heavenly or human, derives from one source, the divine name. End quote. The practical Kabbalists, the sorcerers, bore the title Baal Shem, meaning master of the divine name. The machine language of the world, Hero says. Is this another analogy?
Computers speak machine language, Hero says. It's written in ones and zeros, binary code. At the lowest level, all computers are programmed with strings of ones and zeros. When you program in machine language, you are controlling the computer at its brainstem, the root of its existence. It's the tongue of Eden. But it's very difficult to work in machine language because you go crazy after a while, working at such a minute level. So a whole babble of computer languages has been created for programmers. Fortran, Basic, COBOL, Lisp, Pascal, C, Prolog, Forth. You talk to the computer in one of these languages, and a piece of software called a compiler converts it into machine language. But you never can tell exactly what the compiler is doing. It doesn't always come out the way you want, like a dusty pane or warped mirror. A really advanced hacker comes to understand the true inner workings of the machine. He sees through the language he's working in and glimpses the secret functioning of the binary code. Becomes a Baal Shem of sorts. Lagos believed that the legends about the Tongue of Eden were exaggerated versions of true events, the librarian says. These legends reflect a nostalgia for a time when people spoke Sumerian, a tongue that was superior to anything that came afterward.
Is Sumerian really that good?
Not as far as modern-day linguists can tell, the librarian says. As I mentioned, it is largely impossible for us to grasp. Lago suspected that words worked differently in those days. If one's native tongue influences the physical structure of the developing brain, then it is fair to say that the Sumerians, who spoke a language radically different from anything in existence today, had fundamentally different brains from yours. Lagos believed that for this reason, Sumerian was a language ideally suited to the creation and propagation of viruses. That a virus, once released into Sumer, would spread rapidly and virulently until it had infected everyone.
Maybe Enki knew that also, Hero says. Maybe the Namshub of Enki wasn't such a bad thing. Maybe Babel was the best thing that ever happened to us. Whitey's mom works in Fedland. She has parked her little car in her own little numbered slot, for which the feds require her to pay about 10% of her salary. If she doesn't like it, she can take a taxi or a walk. And walked up several levels of a blindingly lit, reinforced concrete helix, in which most of the spaces, the good spaces closer to the surface, are reserved for people other than her, but empty. She always walks up the center of the ramp, between the rows of parked cars, so that the EBGOC boys won't think she's lurking, loitering, skulking, malingering, or smoking. Reaching the subterranean entrance of her building, she has taken all metal objects from her pockets and removed what little jewelry she's wearing and dumped them into a dirty plastic bowl and walked through the detector. Flashed her badge, signed her name and noted down the digital time. Submitted to a frisking from an EBGOC girl. Annoying, but it sure beats a cavity search. They have the right to do a cavity search if they want. She got cavity searched every day for a month once, right after she had spoken up at a meeting and suggested that her supervisor might be on the wrong track with a major programming project. It was punitive and vicious, she knew it was. But she always wanted to give something back to her country. And whenever you work for the feds, you just accept the fact that there's going to be some politicking. And that as a low-level person, you're going to bear the brunt. And later on, you climb the GS ladder, don't have to put up with as much shit. Far be it from her to quarrel with her supervisor. Her supervisor, Marietta, doesn't have an especially stellar GS level, but she does have access. She has connections. Marietta knows people who know people. Marietta has attended cocktail parties that were also attended by some people who, well, your eyes would bug out. She has passed the frisking with flying colors, put the metal stuff back into her pockets, climbed up half a dozen flights of stairs to her floor. The elevators here still work, but some very highly placed people in Fedland have let it be known, nothing official, but they always have ways of letting this stuff out, that it is a duty to conserve energy. And the Feds are real serious about duty. Duty, loyalty, responsibility. The collagen that binds us into the United States of America. So the stairwells are filled with sweaty wool and clacking leather. If you took the elevator, no one would actually say anything, but it would be noticed. Noticed and written down and taken into account. People would look at you, glance you up and down like, "What happened? Sprained your ankle?" Taking the stairs is no problem. Feds don't smoke. Feds generally don't overeat. The health plan is very specific, contains major incentives. Get too heavy or wheezy, and no one says anything about it, which would be rude, but you feel a definite pressure, a sense of not fitting in. As you walk across the sea of desks, eyes glance up to follow you, estimating the mass of your saddlebags, eyes darting back and forth between desks as, by consensus, your co-workers say to themselves, "I wonder how much he or she is driving up our health plan premiums." So Whitey's mom has clacked up the stairs in her black pumps and gone into her office. Actually, a large room with computer workstations placed across it in a grid. Used to be divided up by partitions, but the EBGOC boys didn't like it. Said, what would happen if there had to be an evacuation? All those partitions would impede the free flow of unhinged panic. So no more partitions, just workstations and chairs. Not even any desktops. Desktops encourage the use of paper, which is archaic, and reflects inadequate team spirit. What is so special about your work that you have to write it down on a piece of paper that only you get to see? That you have to lock it away inside a desk? When you're working for the Feds, everything you do is the property of the United States of America. You do your work on the computer. The computer keeps a copy of everything, so that if you get sick or something, it's all there, where your co-workers and supervisors can get access to it. If you want to write little notes or make phone doodles, you're perfectly free to do that at home, in your spare time. And there's the question of interchangeability. Fed workers, like military people, are intended to be interchangeable parts. What happens if your workstation should break down? You're going to sit there and twiddle your thumbs until it gets fixed? No siree. You're going to move to a spare workstation and get to work on that. And you don't have that flexibility if you've got half a ton of personal stuff cached inside of a desk, strewn around a desktop. So there is no paper in a Fed office. All the workstations are the same. You come in the morning, pick one at random, sit down, and get to work. You could try to favor a particular station, try to sit there every day, but it would be noticed. Generally, you pick the unoccupied workstation that's closest to the door. That way, whoever came in earliest sits closest, whoever came in latest is way in the back. For the rest of the day, it's obvious at a glance who's on the ball in this office and who is, as they whisper to each other in the bathrooms, having problems. Not that it's any big secret who comes in first. When you sign onto a workstation in the morning, it's not like the central computer doesn't notice that fact. The central computer notices just about everything. Keeps track of every key you hit on the keyboard all day long, what time you hit it, down to the microsecond, whether it was the right key or the wrong key, how many mistakes you make, and when you make them. You're only required to be at your workstation from 8 to 5, with a half-hour lunch break and 2 10-minute coffee breaks. But if you stuck to that schedule, it would definitely be noticed,
which is why YT's mom is sliding into the first unoccupied workstation and signing onto her machine at 6:45. Half a dozen other people are already here, signed onto workstations closer to the entrance, but this isn't bad. She can look forward to a reasonably stable career if she can keep up this sort of performance. The Fed still operate in flat land. None of this three-dimensional stuff, no goggles, no stereo sound. The computers are all basic, flat-screen, two-dimensional numbers. Windows appear on the desktop with little text documents inside. All part of the austerity program. Soon to reap major benefits. She signs on and checks her mail. No personal mail, just a couple of mass-distributed pronouncements from Marietta. New TP pool regulations. I've been asked to distribute the new regulations regarding office pool displays. The enclosed memo is a new subchapter of the EBGOC procedure manual, replacing the old subchapter entitled Physical Plant /California /Los Angeles /Buildings /Office Areas /Physical Layout Regulations /Employee Input /Group Activities. The old subchapter was a flat prohibition on the use of office space or time for pool activities of any kind, whether permanent, e.g. coffee pool, or one-time, e.g. birthday parties. This prohibition still applies, but a single one-time exception has now been made for any office that wishes to pursue a joint bathroom tissue strategy. By way of introduction, let me just make a few general comments on this subject. The problem of distributing bathroom tissue to workers presents inherent challenges for any office management system due to the inherent unpredictability of usage. Not every facility usage transaction necessitates the use of bathroom tissue, and when it is used, the amount needed, number of squares, may vary quite widely from person to person, and, for a given person, from one transaction to the next. This does not even take into account the occasional use of bathroom tissue for unpredictable / creative purposes, such as applying, removing cosmetics, beverage spill management, etc. For this reason, rather than trying to package bathroom tissue in small one-transaction packets, as is done with pre-moistened towelettes, for example, which can be wasteful in some cases and limiting in other cases, it has been traditional to package this product in bulk distribution units whose size exceeds the maximum amount of squares that an individual could conceivably use in a single transaction, barring force majeure. This reduces to a minimum the number of transactions in which the distribution unit is depleted, the roll runs out, during the transaction. A situation that can lead to emotional stress for the affected employee. However, it does present the manager with some challenges in that the distribution unit is rather bulky and must be repeatedly used by a number of different individuals if it is not to be wasted. Since the implementation of Phase 17 of the austerity program, employees have been allowed to bring their own bathroom tissue from home. This approach is somewhat bulky and redundant, as every worker usually brings their own roll. Some offices have attempted to meet this challenge by instituting bathroom tissue pools. Without overgeneralizing, it may be stated that an inherent and irreducible feature of any bathroom tissue pool implemented at the office level, in an environment, i.e. building, in which comfort stations are distributed on a per-floor basis, i.e. in which several offices share a single facility, is that provision must be made within the confines of the individual office for temporary stationing of bathroom tissue distribution units, i.e., rolls. This follows from the fact that if the BTDUs, rolls, are stationed while inactive outside of the purview of the controlling office, i.e., the office that has collectively purchased the BTDU, that is, if the BTDUs are stored, for example, in a lobby area or within the facility in which they are actually utilized, they will be subject to pilferage and shrinkage as unauthorized persons consume them. either as part of a conscious effort to pilfer or out of an honest misunderstanding, i.e., a belief that the BTDUs are being provided free of charge by the operating agency, in this case, the United States government, or as the result of necessity, as in the case of a beverage spill that is encroaching on sensitive electronic equipment and whose management will thus brook no delay. This fact has led certain offices, which shall go unnamed, you know who you are, guys, to establish makeshift BTDU depots that also serve as pool contribution collection points. Usually these depots take the form of a table near the door closest to the facility, on which the BTDUs are stacked or otherwise deployed, with a bowl or some other receptacle in which participants may place their contributions, and typically with a sign or other attention-getting device, such as a stuffed animal or cartoon, requesting donations. A quick glance at the current regulations will show that placement of such a display depot violates the procedure manual. However, in the interests of employee hygiene, morale, and group spirit building, my higher-ups have agreed to make a one-time exception in the regulations for this purpose. As with any part of the procedure manual, new or old, it is your responsibility to be thoroughly familiar with this material. Estimated reading time for this document is 15.62 minutes, and don't think we won't check. Please make note of the major points made in this document as follows. 1. BTDU depot displays are now allowed on a trial basis, with the new policy to be reviewed in 6 months. 2. These must be operated on a voluntary pool-type basis as described in the subchapter on employee pools. Note: this means keeping books and tallying all financial transactions. 3. BTDUs must be brought in by the employees, not shipped through the mailroom, and are subject to all the usual search and seizure regulations. 4. Scented BTDUs are prohibited, as they may cause allergic reactions, wheezing, etc. in some persons. 5. Cash pool donations, as with all monetary transactions within the U.S. government, must use official U.S. currency, no yen or Kong bucks. Naturally, this will lead to a bulk problem if people try to use the donation bucket as a dumping ground for bundles of old billion and trillion dollar bills. The buildings and grounds people are worried about waste disposal problems and the potential fire hazard that may ensue if large piles of billions and trillions begin to mount up. Therefore, a key feature of the new regulation is that the donation bucket must be emptied every day. More often, if an excessive buildup situation is seen to develop. In this vein, the B&G people would also like me to point out that many of you who have excess U.S. currency to get rid of have been trying to kill two birds with one stone by using old billions as bathroom tissue. While creative, this approach has two drawbacks. 1. It clogs the plumbing, and 2. It constitutes defacement of U.S. currency, which is a federal crime. Don't do it. Join your office bathroom tissue pool instead. It's easy, it's hygienic, and it's legal. Happy pooling, Marietta.
Whitey's mom pulls up the new memo, checks the time, and starts reading it. The estimated reading time is 15.62 minutes. Later, when Marietta does her end-of-day statistical roundup, sitting in her private office at 9 p.m., she will see the name of each employee and next to it the amount of time spent reading this memo. And her reaction, based on the time spent, will go something like this. Less than 10 minutes. Time for an employee conference and possible attitude counseling. 10 to 14 minutes. Keep an eye on this employee. Maybe developing slipshod attitude. 14 to 15.61 minutes. Employee is an efficient worker, may sometimes miss important details. Exactly 15.62 minutes. Smartass. Needs attitude counseling.
15.63 to 16 minutes. Asswipe, not to be trusted. 16 to 18 minutes. Employee is a methodical worker, may sometimes get hung up on minor details. More than 18 minutes. Check the security videotape. See just what this employee was up to. E.g., possible unauthorized restroom break.
Whitey's mom decides to spend between 14 and 15 minutes reading the memo. It's better for younger workers to spend too long to show that they're careful, not cocky. It's better for older workers to go a little fast to show good management potential. She's pushing 40. She scans through the memo, hitting the page down button at reasonably regular intervals, occasionally paging back up to pretend to reread some earlier section. The computer is going to notice all this. It approves of rereading. It's a small thing, but over a decade or so, this stuff really shows up on your work habit summary. Having got that out of the way, she dives into work. She is an applications programmer for the feds. In the old days, she would have written computer programs for a living. Nowadays, she writes fragments of computer programs. These programs are designed by Marietta and Marietta's superiors in massive week-long meetings on the top floor. Once they get the design down, they start breaking up the problem into tinier and tinier segments, assigning them to group managers, who break them down even more and feed little bits of work to the individual programmers. In order to keep the work done by the individual coders from colliding, it all has to be done according to a set of rules and regulations even bigger and more fluid than the government procedure manual. So the first thing that YT's mother does, having read the new subchapter on bathroom tissue pools, is to sign on to a subsystem of the main computer system that handles the particular programming project she's working on. She doesn't know what the project is. That's classified. Or what it's called. It's just her project. She shares it with a few hundred other programmers. She's not sure exactly who. And every day when she signs on to it, there's a stack of memos waiting for her, containing new regulations and changes to the rules that they all have to follow in writing code for the project. These regulations make the business with the bathroom tissue seem as simple and elegant as the Ten Commandments. So she spends until about 11 a.m. reading, rereading, and understanding the new changes in the project. There are many of these, because this is a Monday morning, and Marietta and her higher-ups spent the whole weekend closeted on the top floor having a catfight about this project, changing everything. Then she starts going back over all the code she has previously written for the project and making a list of all the stuff that will have to be rewritten in order to make it compatible with the new specifications. Basically, she's going to have to rewrite all of her material from the ground up for the third time in as many months. But hey, it's a job. About 11:30, she looks up, startled to see that half a dozen people are standing around her workstation. There's Marietta, and a proctor, and some male feds, and Leon, the polygraph man. "I've just had mine on Thursday," she says. "Time for another one," Marietta says. "Come on, let's get this show on the road."
"Hands out where I can see them," the proctor says.
YT's mom stands up, hands to her sides, and starts walking. She walks straight out of the office. None of the other people look up. Not supposed to. Insensitive to co-workers' needs. Makes the testee feel awkward and singled out, when in fact, the polygraph is just part of the whole Fed way of life. She can hear the snapping footsteps of the proctor behind her, walking two paces behind, watching, keeping her eyes on those hands so that they can't be doing anything, like popping a Valium or something else that might throw off the test. She stops in front of the bathroom door. The proctor walks in front of her, holds it open, and she walks in, followed by the proctor. The last stall on the left is oversized, big enough for two people. YT's mom goes in, followed by the proctor, who closes and locks the door.
YT's mom pulls down her pantyhose, pulls up her skirt, squats over a pan, pees. The proctor watches every drop go into the pan, picks it up, empties it into a test tube that is already labeled with her name and today's date. Then it's back out to the lobby, followed again by the proctor. You're allowed to use the elevators on your way to the polygraph room, so you won't be out of breath and sweaty when you get there. It used to be just a plain office with a chair and some instruments on a table. Then they got the new, fancy polygraph system. Now it's like going in for some kind of high-tech medical scan. The room is completely rebuilt. No vestige of its original function. The window covered over, everything smooth and beige and smelling like a hospital. There's only one chair, in the middle. YT's mom goes and sits down in it, puts her arms on the arms of the chair, nestles her fingertips and palms into the little depressions that await. The neoprene fist of the blood pressure cuff gropes blindly, finds her arm and seizes it. Meanwhile, the room lights are dimming, the door is closing. She's all alone. The crown of thorns closes over her head. She feels the pricks of the electrodes through her scalp, senses the cool air flowing down over her shoulders from the superconducting quantum interference devices that serve as radar into her brain. Somewhere on the other side of the wall, she knows half a dozen personnel techs are sitting in a control room, looking at a big screen blow-up of her pupils. Then she feels a burning prick in her forearm and knows she's been injected with something, which means it's not a normal polygraph exam. Today she's in for something special. The burning spreads throughout her body. Her heart thumps, eyes water. She's been shot up with caffeine to make her hyper, make her talkative. So much for getting any work done today. Sometimes these things go for 12 hours. "What is your name?" a voice says. It's an unnaturally calm and liquid voice, computer-generated. That way, everything it says to her is impartial, stripped of emotional content. She has no way to pick up any cues as to how the interrogation is going. The caffeine and the other things that they inject her with screw up her sense of time also. She hates these things, but it happens to everyone from time to time. And when you go to work for the feds, you sign on the dotted line and give permission for it. In a way, it's a mark of pride and honor. Everyone who works for the feds has their heart in it, because if they didn't, it would come out plain as day when it is their turn to sit in this chair. The questions go on and on, mostly nonsense questions. "Have you ever been to Scotland? Is white bread more expensive than wheat bread?" This is just to get her settled down, get all systems running smoothly. They throw out all the stuff they get from the first hour of the interrogation, because it's lost in the noise. She can feel herself relaxing into it. They say that after a few polygraphs, you learn to relax. The whole thing goes quicker. The chair holds her in place. The caffeine keeps her from getting drowsy. The sensory deprivation clears out her mind. "What is your daughter's nickname?"
"YT."
"How do you refer to your daughter?"
"I call her by her nickname, YT. She kind of insists on it."
"Does YT have a job?"
"Yes. She works as a courier. She works for Rata KS."
"How much money does YT make as a courier?"
"I don't know. A few bucks here and there."
"How often does she purchase new equipment for her job?"
"I'm not aware. I don't really keep track of that."
"Has YT done anything unusual lately?"
"That depends on what you mean."
She knows she's equivocating.
"She's always doing things that some people might label as unusual."
That doesn't sound too good. Sounds like an endorsement of nonconformity.
"I guess what I'm saying is, she's always doing unusual things."
"Has YT broken anything in the house recently?"
"Yes."
She gives up. The feds already know this. Her house is bugged and tapped. It's a wonder it doesn't short out the electric grid, all the extra stuff wired into it.
"She broke my computer."
"Did she give an explanation for why she broke the computer?"
"Yes, sort of. I mean, if nonsense counts as an explanation."
What was her explanation?
She was afraid... This is so ridiculous. She was afraid I was going to catch a virus from it.
Was YT also afraid of catching this virus?
No. She said that only programmers could catch it.
Why are they asking her all of these questions? They have all of this stuff on tape. Did you believe YT's explanation of why she broke the computer?
That's it. That's what they're after. They want to know the only thing they can't directly tap. What's going on in her mind? They want to know whether she believes YT's virus story. And she knows she's making a mistake just thinking these thoughts, because those super-cooled squids around her head are picking it up. They can't tell what she's thinking. But they can tell that something's going on in her brain, that she's using parts of her brain right now that she didn't use when they were asking the nonsense questions. In other words, they can tell that she is analyzing the situation, trying to figure them out, and she wouldn't be doing that unless she wanted to hide something.
What is it you want to know? She says. Why don't you just come out and ask me directly? Let's talk about this face to face. Just sit down together in a room like adults and talk about it.
She feels another sharp prick in her arm, feels numbness and coldness spreading all across her body over an interval of a couple of seconds as the drug mixes with her bloodstream. It's getting harder to follow the conversation.
What is your name?
The voice says.
Ambangala Manuralari.
Yes, Isiana. Yes, you be sheesh.
39. The Alcan, the Alaska Highway, is the world's longest franchise ghetto. A one-dimensional city, 2,000 miles long and 100 feet wide. And growing at the rate of 100 miles a year, or as quickly as people can drive up to the edge of the wilderness and park their bagos in the next available slot. It is the only way out for people who want to leave America but don't have access to an airplane or a ship. It's all two-lane, paved but not well-paved, and choked with mobile homes, family vans, pickup trucks with camper backs. It starts somewhere in the middle of British Columbia at the crossroads of Prince George, where a number of tributaries feed in together to make a single northbound highway. South of there, the tributaries split into a delta of feeder roads that crosses the Canadian-American border at a dozen or more places spread out over 500 miles from the fjords of British Columbia to the vast striped wheatlands of central Montana. Then it ties into the American road system, which serves as the headwaters of the migration. This 500-mile swath of territory is filled with would-be Arctic explorers in great wheeled houses, optimistically northbound, and more than a few rejects who have abandoned their bagos in the North Country and hitched a ride back down south. The lumbering bagos and top-heavy four-wheelers form a moving slalom course for Hero on his black motorcycle. All these beefy Caucasians with guns. Get enough of them together, looking for the America they always believed they'd grow up in, and they glom together like overcooked rice, form integral, starchy little units. With their power tools, portable generators, weapons, four-wheel drive vehicles, and personal computers, they are like beavers hyped up on crystal meth, manic engineers without a blueprint, chewing through the wilderness, building things and abandoning them, altering the flow of mighty rivers, and then moving on because the place ain't what it used to be. The byproduct of the lifestyle is polluted rivers, greenhouse effect, spouse abuse, televangelists, and serial killers. But as long as you have that four-wheel drive vehicle and keep driving north, you can sustain it. Keep moving just quickly enough to stay one step ahead of your own waste stream. In 20 years, 10 million white people will converge on the North Pole and park their bagos there. The low-grade waste heat of their thermodynamically intense lifestyle will turn the crystalline ice cape pliable and treacherous. It will melt a hole through the polar ice cap, and all that metal will sink to the bottom, sucking the biomass down with it. For a fee, you can drive into a snooze and cruise franchise and umbilical your bago.
The magic words are, we have pull-throughs, which means you can enter the franchise, hook up, sleep, unhook, and drive out without ever having to shift your land zeppelin into reverse. They used to claim it was a campground, tried to design the franchise with a rustic motif, but the customers kept chopping up those log and plank signs and wooden picnic tables and using them for cooking fires. Nowadays, the signs are electric polycarbonate bubbles. The corporate identity is all round and polished and smooth in the same way that a urinal is, to prevent stuff from building up in the cracks. Because it's not really camping when you don't have a house to go back to. 16 hours out of California, Hero pulls into a snoozing cruise on the eastern slope of the Cascades in northern Oregon. He's several hundred miles north of where the raft is, and on the wrong side of the mountains. But there's a guy here he wants to interview. There are three parking lots, one out of sight down a pitted dirt road marked with falling down signs, one a little bit closer with scary Harrys hanging around its edges, silvery discs flashing and popping under the full moon as they aim the bottoms of their beer cans at the sky, and one right in front of the town hall with gun-toting attendants. You have to pay to park in that lot. Hero decides to pay. He leaves his bike pointing outward, puts the BIOS into warm shutdown so he can hotboot it later if he has to, throws some Kong bucks at an attendant. Then he turns his head back and forth like a hunting dog, sniffing the still air, trying to find the glade. There's an area 100 feet away under the moonlight where a few people have been adventurous enough to pitch a tent. Usually, these are the ones with the most guns, or the least to lose. Hero goes in that direction, and pretty soon he can see the spreading canopy over the glade. Everyone else calls it the body lot. It is simply an open patch of ground, formerly grass-covered, now covered with successive truckloads of sand that have become mingled with litter, broken glass, and human waste. A canopy is stretched over it to keep out the rain, and big mushroom-shaped hoods stick out of the ground every few feet, exhaling warm air on cold nights. It is pretty cheap to sleep in the glade. It is an innovation that was created by some of the franchises farther south and has been spreading northward along with its clientele. About half a dozen of them are scattered around under the warm air vents, bandaged against the chill in their army blankets. A couple of them have a small fire going, are playing cards by its light. Hero ignores them, starts wandering around through the remainder.
Chuck Wrightson, he says. Mr. President, are you here?
The second time he says it, a pile of wool off to his left begins to writhe and thrash around. A head comes out of it. Hero turns toward him, holds up his hands to prove he's unarmed.
Who is that?
He says. He is abjectly terrified.
Raven?
Not Raven, Hero says. Don't worry. Are you Chuck Wrightson? Former president of the Temporary Republic of Kenai and Kodiak?
Yeah. What do you want? I don't have any money.
Just to talk. I work for CIC, and my job is to gather intelligence.
I need a fucking drink,
Chuck Wrightson says.
The town hall is a big inflatable building in the middle of the snoozin' cruise. It is derelict Las Vegas. Convenience store, video arcade, laundromat, bar, liquor store, flea market, whorehouse. It always seems to be ruled by that small percentage of the human population that is capable of partying until 5 a.m. every single night and that has no other function. Most town halls have a few franchises within franchises. Hero sees a Kelly's tap, which is about the nicest trough you are likely to find at a snoozin' cruise, and leads Chuck Wrightson into it. Chuck is wearing many layers of clothing that used to be different colors. Now they are the same color as his skin, which is khaki. All the businesses in a town hall, including this bar, look like something you'd see on a prison ship. Everything nailed down, brightly lit up 24 hours a day, all of the personnel sealed up behind thick glass barriers that have gone all yellow and murky. Security at this town hall is provided by the enforcers, so there are a lot of steroid addicts in black armor gel outfits cruising up and down the arcade in twos and threes, enthusiastically violating people's human rights. Hiro and Chuck grab the closest thing they can find to a corner table. Hiro buttonholes a waiter and surreptitiously orders a pitcher of pub special mixed half and half with non-alcoholic beer. This way, Chuck ought to remain awake a little longer than he would otherwise. It doesn't take much to make him open up. He's like one of these old guys from a disgraced presidential administration, forced out by scandal, who devotes the rest of his life to finding people who will listen to him.
Yeah, I was president of Trock for 2 years, and I still consider myself the president of the government in exile.
Hiro tries to keep himself from rolling his eyes. Chuck seems to notice.
Okay, so that's not much. But Trock was a thriving country for a while. There's a lot of people who'd like to see something like that rise again. I mean, the only thing that forced us out, the only way those maniacs were able to seize power, was just totally, you know...
He doesn't seem to have words for it.
How could you have expected something like that?
How were you forced out? Was there a civil war?
There were some uprisings early on. And there were remote parts of Kodiak where we never had a firm grip on power. But there was never a civil war per se. See, the Americans liked our government. The Americans had all the weapons, the equipment, the infrastructure. The Orthos were just a bunch of hairy guys running around in the woods.
Orthos?
Russian Orthodox. At first they were a tiny minority. Mostly Indians, you know, Tlingits and Aleuts who'd been converted by the Russians hundreds of years ago. But when things got crazy in Russia, they started to pour across the date line in all kinds of different boats.
And they didn't want a constitutional democracy.
No way.
What do they want? A czar?
No, those czar guys, the traditionalists, stayed in Russia. The Orthos who came to Trock were total rejects. They had been forced out by the mainline Russian Orthodox Church.
Why?
Yeretic. That's how Russians say heretic. The Orthos who came to Trock were a new sect, all Pentecostals. They were tied in somehow with the Reverend Wayne's pearly gates. We had missionaries from Texas coming up all the goddamn time to meet with them. They were always speaking in tongues. The mainline Russian Orthodox Church thought it was the work of the devil.
So how many of these Pentecostal Russian Orthodox people came over to Trock?
Jeez, a hell of a lot of them. At least 50,000.
How many Americans were in Trock?
Close to 100,000.
Then how exactly did the Orthos manage to take the place over?
Well, one morning we woke up, and there was an airstream parked in the middle of Government Square in New Washington, right in the middle of all the bagos where we had set up the government. The Orthos had towed it there during the night, then took the wheels off so it couldn't be moved. We figured it was a protest action. We told them to move it out of there. They refused and issued a proclamation in Russian. When we got this damn thing translated, it turned out to be an order for us to pack up and leave and turn over power to the Orthos. Well, this was ridiculous. So we went up to this airstream to move it out of there, and Gurov's waiting for us with this nasty grin on his face.
Gurov?
Yeah. One of the refugees who came over the dateline from the Soviet Union. Former KGB general turned religious fanatic. He was kind of like the minister of defense for the government that the Orthos set up. So Gurov opens the side door of the airstream and lets us get a load of what's inside.
What was inside?
Well, mostly it was a bunch of equipment, you know. A portable generator, electrical wiring, a control panel, and so forth. But in the middle of the trailer, there's this big black cone sitting on the floor, about the shape of an ice cream cone, except it's about 5 feet long and it's smooth and black. And I ask, what the hell is that thing? And Gurov says,
That thing is a 10-megaton hydrogen bomb we scavenged from a ballistic missile. A city buster. Any more questions?
So you capitulated.
Couldn't do much else. Do you know how the Orthos came to be in possession of a hydrogen bomb?
Chuck Wrightson clearly